Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, we didn't expect to be talking about another deadly terrorist attack on today's media roundtable, but this seems to be our new reality. It was the first major ISIS attack in Spain. Yesterday, 14 people were killed after a van plowed into crowded sidewalks along Las Ramblas. That is Barcelona's most famous spot for tourists and locals. But so far, the media coverage has been fairly predictable. It sounds just like the coverage we got after the last attack. So what will it take to have an honest conversation about why these attacks are happening? Today, we're also going to talk about the horrific stories and images that are still coming out of Charlottesville. They've sparked widespread outrage and international media coverage. Last weekend, we saw white supremacist groups carrying torches, automatic rifles, Confederate flags, and Nazi paraphernalia. Heather Heyer was killed after a Nazi sympathizer ran his car into peaceful marches. So how are the media covering the tragic history of racial inequality and the rise of fascism in the United States? How are the media shaping our public perceptions about what we're facing? How much attention should we spend on these white nationalists as many groups plan to come to different cities across the country, including San Francisco and Berkeley next weekend? We're also getting some breaking news about Steve Bannon. Politico is reporting that Steve Bannon is out as White House chief strategist. This is according to senior administration officials. Politico reports that his departure marks the latest high-level staff shakeup that has rocked the Trump administration. The official said Bannon had resigned on August 7th, but other officials note that Donald Trump had grown tired of his chief strategist approach and had been plotting ways to oust him. So we'll talk about that also on today's show. We're joined today by three journalists. A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica, where he covers the rise in hate crimes as part of the Documenting Hate Project. A.C. is the winner of the 2011 IF Stone Medal for Journalistic Independence, and he just returned from Charlottesville. Hi, A.C. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Sarah Posner, reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah often talks about the intersection of religion and politics. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you.
Nice to have you. Oh, I also wanted to mention that Sarah's October 2016 piece in Mother Jones, which she wrote with David Neuwirth, How Donald Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream, won a Sydney Award from the Sydney Hillman Foundation. And then we're also joined by Martin Reynolds, co-executive director for strategic planning at the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education. Martin also serves as director of the Reveal Investigative Fellowships at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he's co-founder of Oakland Voices, a great community storytelling project that trains residents to serve as community correspondents. Hi, Martin. Thank you for joining us, and welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have all of you. This was a very intense week, and we're going to talk about all these things that are happening. But first, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note, which we all need right now, and highlight journalism that stood out. So, A.C. Thompson, let's start with you. What caught your attention this week?
You know, it's a story a lot of people are talking about, and that's the 22-minute mini Vice documentary about Charlottesville that I thought was really incredible, really powerful and scary. And from being on the ground at that time, I would say it pretty much perfectly captured what was going on there.
This Vice documentary was seen by millions of people, and we're going to talk about that later in the show. But A.C., I think it got a lot of attention because it was just so shocking. But as someone who covers white supremacy and hate, what really grabbed your attention?
You know, I think what grabbed my attention is what I was seeing there, which was the organizational capacity of these groups and their, smart tactics, their ability to pull off their torchlight march and everything else they did. And I think that was the thing that was pretty surprising to me.
And this is available online. All you have to do is search Vice and Charlottesville, but we'll also put a link at yourcallradio.org. That's A.C. Thompson, investigative reporter with ProPublica. And what about you, Sarah Posner? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I agree with AC. You know, that was my first thought about, you know, what the best journalism of the week was. And again, like AC, I've seen this stuff up close myself, and the Vice documentary just puts it in really stark relief that I think that maybe only video is capable of doing. And I thought it really conveyed, I was in Charlottesville too, and it really conveyed the mayhem and the hate and the chaos that was happening there, particularly over the course of Saturday morning and afternoon. I'd also say that Joe Heim at the Washington Post covered the Friday night torch rally in a really vivid way, both on Twitter and in his post coverage of the of that event, and that I think was served as an early warning signal to people who were watching what was going on in Charlottesville that Saturday was not going to be a peaceful event.
That's Sarah Posner. She's a reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And Martin Reynolds, what did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I actually liked a piece by one of our Reveal fellows, actually, Collier Meyerson, who writes for The Nation. And she did a story called Fighting White Supremacy Means Owning Up to American History, and talking about how Trump's failure to swiftly condemn rape and silence is appalling, but that he was actually right, and that it's always been a part of the country's history, and how that in many ways it's often been cloaked, you know, justification for white supremacy is often rested on this veneer of civility, and it's been cloaked in a way that is endeavored to make it more palatable. And in many ways now that it's really changing, and to look at this country and the way that it needs to, this piece sort of broke out that we actually have to really look at it from the perspective of white supremacy is America's history. And that's really how journalists ought to be approaching the story.
Martin Reynolds is co-executive director of the strategic planning at the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education. And we will put all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. Well, let's dive in here. We were going to spend the whole hour talking about Charlottesville, but we obviously cannot ignore the horrific attack that happened yesterday in Spain. This was the first major ISIS attack in Spain. 14 people were killed after a van plowed into crowded sidewalks along Las Ramblas. If you've been to Barcelona, you've definitely gone there because it's such a popular spot for tourists, but also for locals. And I know that you were all, you came prepared to talk about Charlottesville. So I'll throw this out there, and whoever wants to take it, please do. What strikes me about media coverage of these horrific attacks is that it's very predictable. We know what we're going to hear. And we've had a lot of guests on the show, Mark Danner, for example, Andrew Basevich, you know, people from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, talking about why these attacks are happening. What do you think it'll take to have an honest conversation in the national media about why these attacks are happening in the first place? AC,
well,
Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I can jump
Martin.
In real quick. This is Martin. I mean, I think that in many ways, there's a real challenge here in large part. In many ways, the same reason why we don't have these conversations around race in America, in American media. In many ways, because the media is not equipped in many respects to have nuanced conversations about these kinds of topics. And that sort of this notion of patriotism often gets in the way of really sort of digging into what is going on, what is at the root of this. And in many cases, because a lot of what is at the root of many of this, a lot of this hostility and this extremism across the world is had America's hand has been in it. And having a real open and true dialogue about those origins and what role we have played, what role our society has played, what role our government has played, are very touchy and difficult conversations for people to have. They sort of want to look at things as very, very black and white. This horrible thing occurred, and this is why, and these are extremists. We sort of box people into what they are, not sort of understanding the nuances of what is underneath all of those things. And so I think until we're willing to sort of have those hard looks at ourselves, it's going to be very challenging to have a nuanced conversation about these kinds of attacks.
Why do you think we can't have this conversation, Martin? Because when these attacks happen, I think about, for example, those drone whistleblowers who worked, they're former Air Force service members, and they started speaking out in November 2015, basically saying that for every drone you drop, you create a terrorist. Now, these are four young men who are saying these things. This is a perfect opportunity for the media to have them on and have this conversation.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with what the media's role has seen itself to be, right, which is sort of from the outside looking in, not from the inside looking out. And so I think a lot of times and what we're taught in journalism, right, is to sort of stay outside the conversation. And I think these are difficult subjects to have. Often who is in news organizations, right, really in leadership roles, really governs the direction and the dialogue that ensues. And so I think that if you don't have, for instance, a very diverse workforce in your news organization, right, full of diverse backgrounds, people who are Muslim, people perhaps who are non-traditional storytellers, who have been in the military or have just very interesting and different kinds of backgrounds, then the kinds of conversations you're going to have are not necessarily going to capture those topics. And I also think that some of it is fear. I think that the media has not been as courageous as it needs to be for quite some time. And I do think that this 2016 election has been a bit of a wake-up call. I'm seeing, you know, journalists on television all of a sudden actually saying lies, which, you know, there's a debate about that. And so all of a sudden it seems like the media has gone from sort of having a pacifier to actually having a few baby teeth. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, Martin Reynolds is co-executive director for strategic planning at the Robert Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, doing very important work to bring more diversity into newsrooms across the country. Sarah, do you want to add anything?
It's really important to keep in mind as we see these terrorist attacks taking place in the wake of Charlottesville, is that the media really has to stay on top of how Donald Trump is going to use these attacks as a justification for policy initiatives, for law enforcement crackdowns, for beefing up his quest for a Muslim ban or closing the borders or what have you. So I think that there needs to be a lot of alertness in the media about what Trump is saying and doing about it. And I think that I saw some positive signs yesterday when he tweeted about that debunked General Pershing story that he loves to recycle, and that media outlets and mainstream media reporters on Twitter were immediately debunking that and reminding the public that that was a completely debunked story and that he was using a debunked story to promote the committing of a war crime. So I think that we need to be very alert to how Trump is going to try to manipulate these kinds of events to his advantage.
And Sarah, when you say debunked, you mean it never happened, right?
Right.
I mean, that's just incredible. You had to have historians come out and say this never happened.
Mm-hmm. We've never needed historians more than now.
AC Thompson, what would you add?
Important dynamic here that I think largely gets overlooked, which is that there is often a rebound effect in U.S. society when we see one of these terror attacks. And in the past, we had presidents like George W. Bush and others who would say, hey, the problem is not with Islam. The problem is with people who are perverting that religion and committing violence. And there was an attempt to tamp down the rebound. And the rebound is hate crimes against people of color. It's hate crimes against Muslim Americans. It's hate crimes against anyone who looks to be, in the eyes of some folks, to be foreign and potentially some sort of threat. And that is a thing that the current president is doing nothing to tamp down. In fact, he's doing a lot to inflame. And I think the concern every time I see one of these terror attacks is, for me, is what is going to happen in the States? Who is going to be targeted for persecution and hate crimes for something they had absolutely nothing to do with, but they just happened to be a member of the wrong faith, they happen to have the wrong color skin, they happen to have an accent?
Some other people, or a lot of people actually, are talking about the fact that when these attacks happened. The media tend to say, we don't know if it was ISIS yet, but this is a terrorist attack. Whereas when Heather Heyer was killed by a Nazi sympathizer who rammed his car through a group of peaceful protesters, the word terrorist attack was not used. Martin, what are your thoughts on that? And do you think it's important for the media and the government to use terrorist attack in a case like what happened in Charlottesville last Saturday?
I think it's a very good question that journalists need to ask themselves about how that one thing is a terrorist attack and another thing is just a terrible incident that occurs at a violent protest. And so I think that it's sort of looking at me, if you look at, for instance, that if a Nazi hate group or a neo-Nazi extremist group or what have you, is really, in effect, if we were looking at that from afar, and I think there was somebody in the Washington Post that actually did a story, a piece this week about this very thing, that if you actually were to look at the Charlottesville violence from the perspective of a foreign attack and wrote the story that way, it would be written like the attack story in Barcelona, mm-hmm. right? So why is that not? And I'll see if I can find it and mention it as we're in the discussion.
Actually, I read it. What if Western media covered Charlottesville the same way it covers other nations, by Karen Attia with the Washington Post?
Exactly. And so I think that perfectly sums it up, that I think we have to look at it in the same way. And I think, but that's very difficult for us to do and for journalists to want to do or for the country to accept. And so I just think that was a really powerful approach to telling that story.
Sarah, what do you think?
I think that there is a reluctance to call what's perceived as being homegrown terrorism, calling it terrorism, because the perpetrators seem to be, quote-unquote, like us. They don't seem to be, quote-unquote, like the foreigners who might come and commit a terrorist attack, i.e., Muslims, if a Muslim commits a terrorist attack, he's perceived as a foreigner and therefore a terrorist. But if Dylann Roof commits a terrorist attack, such as the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, that's not described as a terrorist attack, but it is. It has all the hallmarks of a terrorist attack. It's designed to inflict death and destruction and instill fear and terror in people. There's no other way to describe it. Yet, it typically doesn't get described that way. We're quick to immediately ascribe terrorism when it fits a certain stereotype in our minds about what a terrorist is. And by and large, we are reluctant to do that when it is a white American who commits the act.
AC, what would you add?
No, I actually, in my reporting, I did describe this as an apparent terror attack because that was clear to me that was what was going on. And, part of what happened was the local government set the agenda for reporters, and they said, hey, we're considering this to be a second-degree homicide investigation. And I thought, what's would happen, at least in a decent world, is the FBI would come in. They would likely classify this under Section 266 of their code as domestic terrorism. That's what it looks like. And I thought, even with Jeff Sessions running the Justice Department, that still may happen. So that's what I'm going to go with, because that's what it looks like to me. And I don't think the second-degree homicide definition is probably too useful at this point.
A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. He covers the rise of hate crimes as part of the Documenting Hate Project. He just returned from Charlottesville. Sarah Posner is a reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. She was also in Charlottesville. And Martin Reynolds is co-executive director at the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education. They do really important work to bring more diversity into newsrooms. And Martin will be speaking at the Commonwealth Club about a variety of issues, including Charlottesville, Monday, August 21st at 6:30. That's in San Francisco, 555 Post Street. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, if you have anything to add about Charlottesville, what are your thoughts about the nonstop media coverage that we're now getting about the horrible things that happen in Charlottesville, white supremacists, fascism, racism, these Confederate statues coming down. I mean, so much is happening right now. What do you want at this moment from the media? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. You know, as a radio producer, I have had a lot of difficulty getting more leftist political or even liberal political views in the mainstream media, in particular NPR stations. I've had great difficulty even finding paying people to help disseminate a radio documentaries that I made that had a voice that was more to the left, where people would just turn on and say, this is too controversial. I mean, I've taken journalism classes at UC Berkeley where ideas were shot down by the teacher that were too controversial, that they were too critical of Israel. Yet at the same time, a student who wanted to do, let's say, for example, a radio documentary on how they are now bilingual schools for middle-class students, young students, and how wonderful that was, completely erasing the whole history in California to get rid of bilingualism, was seen as a wonderful human interest story. I mean, I think that the mainstream media hides behind a veneer of objectivity, but that objectivity is really just a reproduction of their own mainstream values, because that's what seems objective to them.
Hmm. Well, I think I've been finding some really great reporting. I mean, the LA Times had a piece that said, you want to talk about Confederate statues? Let's talk about Native American genocide. I mean, this was in the LA Times. I'm seeing a lot of good stuff, but you really have to spend hours. This is what we do for a living, right? Spend hours looking for these stories. And then we find 10 or 15, and then we connect the dots. Martin, can you comment on Lisa's opinion there? And then just the fact that we now have to kind of piece things together.
Well, yeah, and I understand where Lisa's coming from. I think a lot of times what that has to do with is sort of the people who are in the positions of authority, sort of this gatekeeper mentality that still exists in many news organizations. And to jump on this point about where the stories, and for instance, locally, the stories that I've seen around Charleston, for instance, it focused a lot on the geographic connections of what's happening locally around the Confederate legacy. For instance, Larry News Group pointed out a place in Salinas named the Confederate Corners, which was dubbed that title because it was settled by a group of Southern separatists back in the 1800s. And the story talks a lot about how folks didn't know or didn't know the history and whether they agree or disagree with the removal of monuments. And there's the obligatory quote from the NAACP, and actually a pretty cool Google map that shows names and streets of concentration of federal landmarks across the country, Confederate landmarks across the country, showing their primary cluster in the South, which you'd expect. But then some publications like The Nation and others, which have reporters dedicated to race and politics, are exploring these issues. But news organizations themselves, in large part, are ill-equipped, especially local news organizations, to do this and legacy news organizations, to do this kind of conversations and serve as facilitators around these issues. And in large part because, in many ways, the ethnic media, which is much more equipped to unpack issues like this, is so often under-resourced and seen as niche media, not connecting to the mainstream, although that could be changing. And I would really see that the ethnic media can be as a bridge to this, right? Because these issues, despite the lack of resources that they may have, what they have is a surplus of trust and credibility in communities of color and historical context. But lost in this larger conversation about America being founded on white supremacy, although the person in the other story mentioned it, is the lacking of the larger effort of news organizations to see themselves as being conveners and facilitators and fosters of conversation. That we shouldn't seek to solve these issues, but we should be seen as a collaborator bringing people together to have discussions and dig deeper.
We have an email from Armand who says, even if you have more diversity in newsrooms, are they able to tell the truth and really go in depth on these issues?
Well, it's a good question, because according to the American Society of News Editors Diversity Survey from 2016, the average newsroom workforce in all the 737 digital sites and legacy sites that were polled is only about 11% minority, right? Mm-hmm. And so the impact of that lack of diversity is substantial, and it's reflected in the kinds of stories that are done. It's reflected in the approach to coverage, and as most upper management teams are comprised of largely white men and some women have made gains, it is reflected in the relationships to the community. And I'm not saying that you have to be a person of color to cover race, but as a news organization, you have to reflect the diversity of your community. And people of different backgrounds, what they bring, they bring their experiences, who they are, the stories that they want to tell, the sources that they have, the perspectives that they hold. You know, journalism is not stenography, and who we are is brought with us to these conversations. And to Armand's point, he's right, that if a lot of times journalists of color in news organizations that want to bring issues, bring perspectives forward, run into resistance, right, from editors who miss what is called the fault line. And I'll get into that later.
There's a great piece at the Columbia Journalism Review called Diversity in Newsrooms Has Been Bad for Decades, and it probably won't get any better, according to that same study that you just mentioned, Martin. Martin Reynolds is co-executive director at the Robert C. Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, and they work to bring more diversity into our newsrooms. We're also joined by A.C. Thompson. Oh, and Martin is going to be speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, having a wide-ranging conversation about all of these issues Monday, August 21st at 6:30, 555 Post Street. A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. He covers the rise of hate as part of the Documenting Hate Project. He was just in Charlottesville. Sarah Posner was also just in Charlottesville. She's a reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute and author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. After the break, we will ask Sarah and A.C. to talk about what they saw in Charlottesville and what they think is missing from some of the coverage. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, Inflection Point with your host, Lauren Schiller. She'll be talking with Jeanette Walls, who talks about her rise out of a crumbling home where her parents couldn't always put food on the table. Walls finally revisiting her upbringing in her memoir on Inflection Point, coming up at 11.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the horrific, deadly attack that took place in Charlottesville last weekend. We're also talking about white supremacy, the rise of fascism. The big question right now is, what do you want the media to focus on? There's so many stories coming out right now about the history of this country, Confederate statues, just so much out there. How do you think the media should really focus its attention at this really important time in our history? A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. Sarah Posner is a reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Martin Reynolds is co-executive director of the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education. Sarah and A.C., you just got back from Charlottesville, and you both have written about what you saw there. I'm just wondering, A.C., since this issue is getting so much attention, do you think anything is missing based on what you experienced, the people that you interviewed?
You know, I think there's a lot that's missing, and part of it is the context, right? Is that there have been right-wing and racist terror attacks going on in America for decades, but in particular in recent years, there's been a significant uptick in those kind of incidents, and it starts at the beginning of the Obama administration, and has gotten particularly bad in the last few years. So part of what I think is missing is the context, right? Charlottesville was not the first white racist terror incident that we've seen recently. It is just part of a string of them, from the shooting of five Black Lives Matter protesters a couple of years back in Minnesota, to the sword stabbing of an African-American gentleman in Times Square recently, to the plot by a group called Adam Waffen down in Tampa, Florida, to build a bomb and bomb a nuclear power plant, to the plan by a guy in South Carolina to carry out a white terror attack in the spirit of Dylann Roof. So I think that's the sort of context that's missing.
Sarah, what about that context? Because you wrote this incredible piece for Mother Jones, How Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream. And you write about something that took place in June 2015 as Trump joined the crowded field of Republican presidential candidates. In the lobby of Trump Tower, he announced he would build a wall to keep out Mexican criminals and rapists. And then you write that Andrew Anglin, publisher of the neo-Nazi site Daily Stormer, 12 days later said, I urge all readers of this site to do whatever they can to make Trump president. And Sarah, I was thinking about your reporting this week as I hear these radio hosts, TV hosts, ask nonstop, why isn't Donald Trump speaking out more strongly about what happened here? And I thought, have people been paying attention to what's happened in this country in the last 2 years?
Right. Donald Trump, from the moment he announced his candidacy, electrified the very people who we saw descend on Charlottesville this past weekend. These were the people that not only did he electrify, but that he made them feel like they had come out of the shadows, that they were no longer hidden or had to try to be hidden, that he had normalized them, whether it was by refusing to denounce them or denouncing them only in perfunctory and begrudging ways, or when he retweeted a tweet from an account whose handle was White Genocide, which is a phrase used by these groups because they claim that immigration and multiculturalism is leading to a genocide of white people in America. When he retweeted fake statistics about black crime, these were the things that not only thrilled them, but made them think that, oh, like, our views are shared by someone who's running for president, and then eventually our views are shared by somebody who got the Republican nomination, and then eventually our views are shared and made, you know, and amplified by the person who's president of the United States. So, when we did that story for Mother Jones, we had a list of about two dozen right-wing extremists who had endorsed Trump. We had their endorsements, other things that they had said, whether about, race or Jews or Muslims or what have you. We took that list to the Trump campaign on multiple occasions, gave them the opportunity to denounce these people and distance themselves from these endorsements, which I think in almost any other candidate, Republican or otherwise, would have done. And we got radio silence from them. So when Trump really refused this week to denounce what happened in Charlottesville and to denounce white supremacists specifically and to denounce these particular groups who had showed up in Charlottesville, that to me was in character because he had long refused not only to denounce them, but to distance himself from them.
Sarah, what do you think about how the broadcast media are covering that and they're repeating this question, why won't Trump come out and denounce these people?
Well, I think that there's a certain level of denial or disbelief that the President of the United States cannot bring himself to denounce Nazis. But, and I think that it was because we collectively, when I say we, I just mean our society, collectively just refused to see basically what we were saying in that Mother Jones piece, that he winked and nodded with them, refused to denounce them or distance himself from them, and made them feel emboldened and empowered. And when I got to Charlottesville on Saturday, that's all I could think about was that he had done this, that he had made these people feel like they were okay and they were good.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line. That's Sarah Posner, reporter with the Investigative Fund. A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. Martin Reynolds is co-executive director of the Maynard Institute for Journalism. And let's go to Tom in San Francisco. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
You asked a question before about what we'd like to see covered by the media. And one of the things I thought of was there was an editorial in New York Times that was kind of, it was very cute and a little bit funny about how Trump needs to be distracted by shiny objects. And I think one of the things that Trump seems to be doing, both impulsively and maybe consciously, is distracting all of us with these completely outrageous comments and acts and positions. And in the meantime, underneath the surface, federal agencies and cabinet leaders are dismantling our democracy and doing all kinds of really heinous things that have real impact on the day-to-day life of people. And I know that for journalists, you know, it's expedient to deal with what's most sensational and what's kind of in fashion. And so it's hard to get into the nitty-gritty of what really affects the lives of so many different people across so many different areas. But, you know, I think it would be in the media seems to move sort of in swarms, you know, on these big resonant subjects. It would be really great if they continue to get the good coverage they do, but that some group of people peel off and really look underneath the surface of what's really happening and the impact that that's having. And I wish there were more reporting in that kind of area.
Yeah, it's a great point. And we're actually thinking about starting a series called Beyond the Tweets to focus specifically on exactly what you're talking about, judges being appointed. I mean, this is serious stuff. And the rollback of environmental protections, of workplace protections. The list goes on. We're going to do a show actually about this starting next Wednesday. So I hope you can tune in for that. Martin, would you like to comment on that? He's right. So much is happening behind the scenes, and it is getting some coverage. But again, you really have to look for it. It's not being amplified in the broadcast media, for example.
Yeah, and I think that there's, a lot of reasons for that. I mean, the implosion of media over the last 10 years has been significant, right? More than 1,500, perhaps 2,000 journalism jobs have been lost in over just a 3 or 4 year period after between 2008 and 2011. And so that is significant. And the commoditization of news, I mean, I've worked in corporate media for many years. I was the editor of the Oakland Tribune. I came up through the ranks there, starting as an intern and being a reporter and a managing editor and editor and so on and so forth. And sort of, you know, that was where I cut my teeth and really believed in it. And then this collapse of media and the model, the financial model, has really made me believe that there are a number of things in this world that shouldn't be about unbridled profit, and journalism is one of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that what has happened, the effort to try and, you know, figure out how to sustain a model that is collapsing has made a huge problem. The number of cuts that have happened in news organizations, the consolidation of news organizations, the collapsing of mastheads of newspapers, the consolidation of copy desks, all of this contributes, right, to an erosion of credibility, an erosion of capacity, and an effort to sort of try and break through the noise, right? Understanding the analytics, which are a wonderful thing, have also shown us to get a sense of, well, what direction ought we go in? And a lot of the times that's not necessarily a good thing. Like, what is the sexy story that is really critical for folks to read and is really nuanced and data-driven and has a lot of deep-packed information may not be the most sexy, exciting story that a tweet easily enables the broadcaster to throw up and it's some inflammatory comment. So I completely agree with that. I think that in many ways journalists, in many respects, we have lost our way and our focus, and we need to rethink this approach and not simply allow the audience, right, to govern the direction we go. I mean, part of the reason that a front page of a newspaper, and I'm sounding like an old ink-stained wretch here, but why the front page of a newspaper was so important was because it was a little bit of what you wanted to see and a little bit of what you needed to see. And newspaper editors took time to think about that. Nowadays, people have the ability to sort of customize their own experience, their own perspective, their own worldview. And the Internet has democratized information, but it has also fractured us in many respects.
Well, Martin, I know we have to let you go, so thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back soon.
It was a pleasure. AC, hope you're doing well, man. You're doing great work. Be well.
Thank you. Good to hear from you, man.
All right, take care.
Thank you. That is Martin Reynolds. He's co-executive director of the Maynard Institute for Journalism Education, where they work to diversify newsrooms. And Martin will be speaking on a panel about all of these issues Monday, August 21st at 6:30 at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco, 555 Post Street. On these issues, AC and Sarah, you work for news organizations that do incredible reporting, this kind of reporting. AC, you're an investigative reporter with ProPublica. I'm looking at your website. website right now, and the headlines are incredible. ICE officers told to take action against all undocumented immigrants encountered while on duty. There's just so much. Border agency set to jumpstart Trump's wall in a Texas wildlife refuge. Story after story. The challenge is to make sure that people see these stories.
Yeah, you know, and I think Martin, by the way, who was one of my editors at the Chauncey Bailey Project, you know, I think he just hit on it. We just had this conversation right before I got on the phone at the ProPublica newsroom, and it was like, what are we going to do about race, about hate crimes, about white terrorism that's on the news cycle, and what are we going to do that is the deeper dive, the substantial story that's more important, that takes more resources, it takes more money. And then, exactly, how are we going to get people to actually pay attention to that deeper story? For example, if we wait a month to do a deep dive on a particular racist group that we're interested in, a month from now, will people still care, or will they be focused on something else? And will we be just telling that story to ourselves?
Sarah, same thing at the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. So many great stories. The new war on birth control, purging climate scientists for telling the truth. What would you add?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously, you know, I agree with you about the great work done at the Nation Institute. But I would just add that I do think that major newspapers like the Washington Post and the New York Times have stepped up on a lot of this accountability-type reporting. ProPublica and the New York Times have collaborated on a project that's looking at how Trump is, you know, starving the agencies of political appointees and personnel, and also at the type of personnel that he is appointing to these many vacancies that he still hasn't filled. There's a project that's looking at all of the deregulation that's happening under Trump. So, like, the caller earlier was talking about how Trump distracts us with his tweets, and he's distracting the public from what he's doing to the government in terms of this massive deregulation and either leaving agencies vacant or staffing them with ideologues. And I do think that it's important to point out the good reporting that mainstream media is doing on those subjects. That takes a lot of reporter power and reporter hours, and I think that they're putting that into it. And so I wouldn't want to see just like a wholesale bashing of the way mainstream media is covering Trump. I agree with Martin's assessment on the diversity issues, but I do think that there's a lot of important, like, sort of government accountability reporting going on.
Yeah. Sarah Posner is a reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, and A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica, and they both were in Charlottesville covering the marches, the deadly attack last weekend. Let's hear from Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, this is a little off the subject, but I can't find anybody that actually talks about what it is from their writings, their statements, I don't know what, that all the hate groups, the white supremacists, neo-Nazis, etc., what is it that they really want to do about the blacks, the minorities, the immigrants? Well, no, the immigrants, I know what they want to do, but in other words, do they ultimately want to kill them all? Do they ultimately want to just suppress them as much as possible? Do they ultimately want a lynching to come back? I mean, what is it they really want to do? I mean, it seems very sinister and not something that they're probably cautious about giving their ultimate, you know, but does anybody have any information on that?
Thank you. AC, what would you say?
Yeah, well, I would say that I interviewed somebody from the Daily Stormer, the neo-Nazi website, and when asked about that question, he said he wanted to gas the Jews, and he used the racist slang for Jew. You know, so I think when you talk to these people, what they want is they want a white ethnostate, a white homeland, and that's an old idea. That's an idea that's been circulating through white supremacist circles for decades. The white Aryan resistance and the Aryan nations, they were talking about this stuff in the 80s. And I think what they would like to do is eventually push all people of color, all Jews, all Muslims out of this country one way or another. And the new country may be called America. It may be called something else, but it would be an ethnically homogenous state. And there's a belief in this scene that ethnic homogeneity is the only way to have a sort of cohesive society, and they are sort of taking the Pat Buchanan line and taking it as far as you can go with it.
What about the young people we saw last weekend in Charlottesville, AC? The young guys, a lot of them are college students wearing khakis, white polo shirts, and the red Make America Great Again hats. I mean, you look at them and you just wonder, where did you get these beliefs? Like, what is your life like right now? What is happening with you? I mean, did you interview any of those guys?
Yeah, dozens.
And what did they say?
You know, I mean, you kind of get two stories, right? And one is you get the boilerplate sort of white supremacist stuff that is hard to get through. And then when you get around that and you get to the real story, you get to a story about people feeling afraid. They're afraid of terrorist attacks. They're afraid that there may not be a job for them. They're afraid that they may become a minority in a country that is populated largely by people of color. And it's a story about fear, and it's a story about disconnection and lacking any sort of real purpose in life. Mm-hmm. And so they find other people, and then they find a community, and then they find a purpose and a higher calling. And it's a hateful higher calling, but it's better than to them than being afraid and being alone and having no purpose in life.
And Sarah, what would you add?
Well, I would add that that conspiracy theories play and websites and so-called news sites that perpetuate those conspiracy theories play a big role in shaping how people who show up at these types of events think about these issues and think about people who are not white. And I mean, I think people talk a lot about sort of Reddit and 4chan and those chat boards where a lot of this stuff, you know, during the Trump era has gotten talked about, InfoWars, Alex Jones, and like I just repeatedly meet people who find their quote unquote information from those sorts of places, and it's very troubling.
It's very troubling,
absolutely.
And also the violence is very troubling. I'm looking at a photo right now of young men beating with sticks and punching and kicking a 20-year-old aspiring hip-hop artist, DeAndre Harris. And this guy, this poor guy, was beaten in a garage, and now he has a GoFundMe campaign to raise money for his healthcare bills. There's horrible footage, AC, I'm sure you've seen it, about DeAndre getting up and trying to run, but he was so hurt that he just kept falling. So, I mean, we're talking about major violence, and I really want to give a shout-out to TheRoot.com because they've done some incredible reporting looking at the stories behind the photos and the videos.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing, right? If you believe that you are the victim of an ongoing genocide, and these are white folks that believe that white people are being wiped off the face of the earth, if you are in that place, and because of conspiracy theories and because of everything else, you've come to that belief, then it's very easy to justify extreme measures and violence. And when you couple that with the fact that it is still, despite the things the president does, a taboo to be an out open racist in American society, it still is. And these guys, when they come to a place like Charlottesville, they're one, fueled by this notion of like, hey, we're the victims of a genocide, we need to fight back, racial holy war. And two, they know they're going to get extreme resistance from a lot of people who are going to start pelting them with bottles, who are going to throw rocks at them, who are going to want to punch them. And so they are in a state of believing that they need to engage in physical combat. And when they see the people that have been demonized in their eyes, the people that are the cause of the problems in the country in their eyes, then they will attack. It's just to be expected, absolutely to be expected.
And just quickly, Sarah, how serious is this? I mean, we could do a week-long series about these groups. According to the Center for the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are 900 hate groups across the country. How big is this? Should they be getting this much media attention?
Well, obviously, many of them are very small in number compared to the rest of the population, right? And as we saw in Charlottesville, they can come out in force and have lethal effects. And as AC has pointed out, even they have taken people's lives and threatened people's lives in smaller spaces and smaller places that, you know, we often don't even hear about. So they are extremely dangerous. And I think another thing that we need to remember that's really dangerous about this is that when they use the taking down of the General Lee statute as their pretext for coming to Charlottesville, that sort of gives fuel to the idea that there are people who don't really share their extremist beliefs or their violent beliefs, but who have this affinity for their so-called, you know, Southern heritage and the Confederate statues and monuments and so forth. And so, like, because the Confederate statues get sort of like mixed up in all of this, and there are less extreme people who share those sorts of beliefs about the Confederate monuments, then we get sort of distracted from the fact that they really went to Charlottesville for something much more extreme than a statue.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will definitely continue to follow this issue. Sarah Posner is a reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, author of God's Prophets. A.C. Thompson is an investigative reporter with ProPublica, and check out his Documenting Hate project. Sarah and A.C., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're going to end today's show with some sound from Susan Breaux. She is Heather Heyer's mother. Heather is the 32-year-old who was killed after a Nazi sympathizer intentionally drove his car into a set of peaceful marchers. And earlier this week, there was a ceremony for Heather, there was a service for Heather, and Susan Breaux has since said that she is receiving death threats. She told MSNBC on Thursday, "I've had death threats already because of what I'm doing right now." Here's a clip of Susan Breaux talking about her daughter.
"We're not going to sit around and shake hands and go kumbaya, and I'm sorry. It's not all about forgiveness. I know that that's not a popular trend. But the truth is, we are going to have our differences. We are going to be angry with each other. But let's channel that anger not into hate, not into violence, not into fear, but let's channel that difference, that anger, into righteous action."
And that was Susan Breaux, the mother of Heather Heyer, who was killed on Saturday. On her Facebook page, she had a quote that said, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." KALW is produced here at, Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and David Latulipe, who's our studio engineer. You can find more information about our show. You can also podcast it, yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.